I'm Colin Woodard, author of Nations Apart, How Clashing Regional Cultures Shattered America. I'm the founder of Nationhood Lab at Salve Regina University's Pell Center for International Relations and Public Policy, where we study the problems of United States nationhood and try to solve them. I started my professional life in Eastern Europe and the Balkans, where I was on a university semester abroad program when communism collapsed, and where I spent most of my 20s, the 1990s, as a journalist covering the transition, the fall and rise of authoritarian regimes, and the war and aftermath in Yugoslavia and Bosnia-Herzegovina. I later won a George Polk Award and was a finalist for a Pulitzer Prize for my investigative work at Maine's largest newspaper, the Portland Press-Herald. And I've written 6 previous books, including American Nations, The Republic of Pirates, and Union, which tells the story of the struggle to create a national story for the United States. Today, I'm a scholar of U.S. regionalism, nationalism, and national identity, and a fellow of the Royal Geographical Society in London. I'm going to share with you 5 of the key insights from Nations Apart. Insight number 1. The United States isn't a nation state. It's a federation of stateless nations. We're really a collection of stateless nations, each with their own intents, ideals, and stories of national purpose. These stateless nations, these regional cultures, go back to the beginning of European conquest and settlement, to the 17th and early 18th centuries. The original clusters of colonies were settled by people from distinct regions of the British Isles, and from France, the Netherlands, and Spain, each with their own religious, political, and ethnographic characteristics. Each was first colonized at a separate time and under a different political model. Some championed individualism, others utopian social reform. Some embraced an Anglo-Protestant identity, others ethnic and religious pluralism. Some valued equality and democratic participation, others deference to an aristocratic order modeled on the slave states of classical antiquity. The Puritan project in New England had little in common with the neo-feudal aristocratic society of the Chesapeake country, or with the Dutch commercial colony encompassing what's now Greater New York City, or New Spain's far-flung northern frontier, or the West Indies Slave Society planted in the deep southern lowlands by English planters from Barbados. For generations, these discrete Euro-American cultures developed in remarkable isolation from one another, consolidating their own cherished principles and fundamental values, and expanding over the continent in nearly exclusive settlement bands. They saw themselves as competitors, for land, for settlers, for capital, and even as enemies, taking opposing sides in the English Civil War of the 1640s, in the American Revolution, the War of 1812, and most obviously, the U.S. Civil War. The point I'm making is that there's never been an America, but rather several Americas. And today, there are 9 major ones, and enclaves of several others, primarily located outside our borders. And these Americas have always been divided on key issues, with profound effects on American history, society, and democracy. Insight number 2. The differences between our regional cultures profoundly shape American life today. At Nationhood Lab, we study these effects, which dramatically influence most aspects of American life, from elections to gun control, from popular opinion on abortion, climate change, or immigration, to stark divides in life expectancy, COVID-19 deaths, household credit worthiness, economic mobility, and a wide range of health outcomes. Gaps that persist even if you control for wealth, race, education, urbanity, and other factors. If you map these phenomena at the county level, be it election results, COVID vaccination rates, FICO credit scores, or per capita gun deaths, the centuries-old rival settlement patterns stare you right in the face. Such maps are in Nations Apart, and the dozens of peer-reviewed academic papers we've produced in collaboration with scientific experts spread across various disciplines and across our continent. Insight number 3. These regions disagree on how to create a free and healthy society, but the data does not. One seminal difference between our regional cultures: they've never agreed on how to go about the American experiment, how to create a society where humans can be maximally and sustainably free. Do you emphasize individual liberty, maximizing individual autonomy by, say, keeping taxes low and regulations, services, and the safety net weak? Or do you do it by building and maintaining a free society, which requires the opposite policy stance? Our politics, up until 2016 anyway, centered on this question, which is why you can see the American nation's settlement map regularly reflected in county-level election results. The individualistic regions, they're the ones in the South and Interior West, always supported the more individualistic party. The Jeffersonians in the 1810s, Jacksonian Democrats in the antebellum period, white supremacist Democrats from the 1860s to, say, the 1960s, and Republicans today. The communitarian ones, Yankeedom, the greater New England cultural space, New Netherland around New York City, the Midlands, Left Coast, El Norte in the Spanish Southwest, voted for the Federalists in the 1810s, the Whigs in the 1830s, Lincolnian Republicans in the 1860s and 1960s, and Democrats today. But in terms of which approach has better outcomes, the data is clear, at least in terms of health, wealth, longevity, safety, and resilience. In almost every data set we've analyzed, life expectancy, social vulnerability, intergenerational economic mobility, per capita levels of gun deaths, diabetes, disabilities, obesity, arthritis, stroke, COVID-19 mortality, sleep disturbances, household debt, food insecurity, and the metrics of well-being, the communitarian regions had better metrics, sometimes many times better than the individualistic ones did. For instance, per capita white gun homicides are 5 times higher in the southern regions than they are in the Dutch-founded area around New York City. The COVID-19 death rate over the pandemic in the Deep South was 2.5 times higher than in the region I call the Left Coast, which is the narrow plain between the Pacific and the mountains, stretching from Monterey, California to the Alaska Panhandle. And it was 5 times higher than that of Hawaii. Life expectancy in the richest counties in the United States that happen to be in the Deep South is lower than that of the poorest counties in the United States that happen to be in Yankeedom, the greater New England cultural space that spreads over much of the Upper Great Lakes region. Insight number 4. The ultimate eternal American struggle pits the Declaration's ideals against blood and soil nationalism, and the latter has seized power. Our country came about accidentally. The regional cultures on the eastern seaboard allied in 1776 to face off a common threat, a change in British imperial policy that threatened each colony's own ways of doing things. And miraculously, this ragtag alliance won. And they found themselves in something called the United States of America, but nobody was really sure what that was. The story of United States nationhood, of what this new country's purpose was, of who belonged, of where it came from and where it was going, had to be created ex post facto. And by the time we really got around to doing so, in the 1830s and 1840s, there were two stories competing with one another. Two stories of America that could not coexist. A contest over identity and purpose that has continued to this day. One story said that, yes, we may lack a shared history, religion, or ethnicity, but what we do share are those ideals in the Declaration. That each human has a natural and equal right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. To be American, in this tradition, is to be committed to this set of propositions about the nature of the universe, and to create a society dedicated to making those ideals a reality. But this story was contested immediately, from the 1830s onward, by a counter-narrative, crafted by a circle of Southern intellectuals who said, no, the Declaration is wrong. Humans are not equal. Only the Anglo-Saxon race, they argued, had the genius and ability to secure the promises in the Declaration. We're a classical republic, like ancient Greece and Rome, they said, where a minority had the privilege or liberty to practice democracy, and subjugation or slavery were the natural lot of everyone else. It was an ethno-national and inherently authoritarian vision. This has been our defining conflict ever since, in the antebellum period, in the Civil War and Reconstruction, and the Jim Crow era. The ethno-nationalists actually ruled this country in the 1910s and 1920s, when the first deep Southern president, Woodrow Wilson, segregated the federal government. When they were putting up the Confederate statues we're now tearing down. When Birth of a Nation was all the rage, a film celebrating the KKK's successful terrorist campaign to restore white supremacy in the occupied South. When the 1924 Immigration Act imposed racial quotas to defend the Anglo-Saxon character of the country. And now, they're back. Insight number 5. The vast majority of Americans actually agree on what kind of country we're supposed to be. I wrote about our past struggles for national identity in my previous book, Union. And at Nationhood Lab, we've been studying how they shape the nation's fateful trajectory today. We conducted months of historical research, multiple national polls, and dozens of in-depth interviews with representative Americans. And the most surprising thing we learned right from the outset is that most Americans really do support and prefer the Declaration's ideals over those of ethno-nationalists, like Vice President J.D. Vance, who recently argued Americanness is linked to one's ancestry, specifically to the almost entirely white Anglo-Saxon Protestant colonizers who tamed wild indigenous North America between 1604 and 1890. In our polling, we offered registered voters competing statements about our national purpose, American identity, and the meaning of our past. In each case, one of these statements was keyed off the ideals in the Declaration, the other rooted in more intrinsic characteristics, like ancestry, heritage, character, and values. In every case, substantial majorities of Americans preferred the Declaration's universal civic values, regardless of the gender, age, race, education, or region of the respondent. We later tested if Americans agree with the argument that we are duty-bound, as Americans, to protect one another's natural rights to life and liberty and so forth. And they did. By an incredible 97-2 margin, one of the widest our pollsters had ever seen. This included 95% of Republicans, Trump 2020 voters, and evangelicals. There's some common ground we can work with. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoy the book.